The regular supplemental meetings are called to order. We're going to go ahead and recess the supplemental meeting. Let's start off with a moment of silence for those people that are not with us anymore. Thank you. Let's go ahead and move to the consent agenda. The first thing we have are the minutes from the last meeting. Do we have any comments or questions about those? And do we need to approve both the public meeting and the regular meeting?
They both need to be approved.
No.
You can do them together if you'd like.
Who is three?
All right, so we have a motion to go ahead and approve both sets of minutes.
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda, Kelly, anything you want to flag on that?
This is the time of year where we do the earnings test for disability retirees, and there are nine on here that have all passed the earnings test, which means we don't have to produce their benefits. So you only see that once or twice a year, depending on how we do it. And there's also a SWAR, and for those of you that don't know, a SWAR is spouse wed after retirement, and that is where a member elects to reduce their benefit after they retire because they remarried or married a spouse that they didn't have before. Just to add, you can also add a child later. We call that a CAR. We don't have those.
No, nobody failed the earning test then, I presume?
Pardon me?
No one failed the earnings test?
No.
They're all approved.
Right. So that's all.
Okay, so can we have a motion to approve the detailed consent agenda?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Let's now go to briefing items. First thing we have, public comment. Do we have anyone either present or on the phone that would like to make a public comment?
We'll have everybody on the phone.
Okay. All right, good. Okay, so now we're going to move to item C1. Kelly, you're going to talk about the employee handbook and policies.
Yeah, so at our last board meeting in May, I went over a short PowerPoint to talk about the employee handbook, and since that time we've made some changes based on some comments at the board meeting and just cleaning up some different items and talking to employees. So the handbook's here. It still says draft on it. If you choose to approve this today, we'll make another run through, make sure we don't have any typos and, you know, minor cleanup type things like that. But it's generally complete at this point. The computer related policies, we've decided to attach as an exhibit because those aren't ready. We're still working through those. But just to remind you, the reason that we did this is the system had a lot of old policies that hadn't been updated for a long time, and many of them were out of date, and employees didn't know where to find them. So we decided to put all this together, bring it up to date with the current environment and current laws, and we put this together here. In doing this, the major changes that we talked about last time was we eliminated the concept of the attendance incentive leave program because it wasn't working for us. And in that program, employees could earn up to 6 days of vacation. We eliminated that program and moved 3 of the days to extra sick leave and 3 of the days to personal days, which actually benefits the pension system because those don't accrue year to year and they don't get paid out when an employee leaves. So we made that change. We also added the same number of holidays that the city has, and we reduced the personal day because we did have personal days. So those are the major changes in the handbook. Did anybody have any questions or concerns after?
How different is our policies than the city's policies? I mean, look at sick time and vacation, and they just seem...
They're pretty identical because when we came over from the city, we had the same policies, and over time, they've added some and made some tweaks, but They have a policy on parental leave that we did not recommend adding here just because our organization is so small. But other than that, they're pretty, they came from the city, and the city will now have AIL, which when you talk to the controller's office over there and the CFO, the first thing they say when you mention AIL is, we hate AIL. So they are trying to find a way to change it as well. So we will be different now in that respect. Comments? Okay. If you approve this item, what we'll do is I clean it up. We'll add the exhibit. Josh, does the exhibit need to come back to the board for approval?
Yeah, because it's pretty substantive,
okay.
So we bring it back as a further approval.
And that'll just be the computer policies. And then we will rescind. There's 13 policies that we will rescind. Some were board approved and some weren't, but we would take this motion to rescind those policies that were board approved that are incorporated in here.
Okay, so we'll go ahead and do a motion.
Yeah.
Any comments or questions? All right, do we have a motion to approve the employee handbook?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Okay, the communication plan, Bill and Kelly?
Yeah. We talked about the communication plan, and we've deferred that a little bit, and I thought I'd give a little background on why and where we are at this point in time. But basically, in August of 2020, when my first term was about to expire, I notified the mayor that we had done a lot of good things in trying to beef up the system, but that we still needed a major infusion of funding in order to be viable going forward. At that time, he asked me to head up an informal study group to look at what options are there for funding the pension plan. And during the fourth quarter of 2020, we put together a group of people. It was Rob Walters, who formerly was on the board. Cullen Clark was a professor over at SMU. Rick Porter, who was an attorney at Mark's firm. Joe Colonetto, who had worked in private equity. Ryan Bailey and myself. So it took us a good 3 or 4 months to recruit a reasonable number of people. In the first half of 2021, we worked with the city staff to try to, just understand what was there, what various options may exist. We also then went out and worked with a number of consulting firms, the Reasons Foundation, which is a specialist in city activities, either privatizing assets or looking at revenue streams, and they've done a lot of work. We also worked with the Pew Foundation, and we worked with the Arnold Group. We started with the Arnold Group, who's a local one who had done a lot of this work, but they were in the process of getting out of the business, basically. So the Reasons Foundation is the one who's really has the expertise in these areas. We also did consult with other firms, some actuarial firms, our actuaries, other actuaries. We consulted with Bank of America has a team in public finance kinds of issues. So it took us pretty much into the fall last year of 2021 to put together a series of recommendations to the mayor's office and the city manager's office. And we presented those last fall, and they included things like a POB bond, adopting our actuarial funding policy, dedicating certain revenue streams the city potentially could have, funding that additional thing, privatizing assets to take some proceeds. So we did that in the fall last year. Between the fall and early winter, city staff started to evaluate them and look at them. Now, a lot of these options are very complex, and they take a lot of other parties getting involved. So we basically had till basically the spring the city was working on it. It's my understanding now the mayor is working this through and is hoping to have something to go forward in the fall, probably in September sometime. There'll be a discussion and bringing forward some of these recommendations and trying to implement them and going through the complexities that need to be done. At the same time, we were looking at this communication plan, and the city has said, hey, we're not ready to launch. You'd be premature. You're getting in front of us. And it wouldn't be helpful. And really, this whole project is theirs. I mean, this is the city. We can't create funding anyway. We don't have a way to raise bond money or do anything else. So they've asked us to sort of hold off a little bit till they're ready to launch it in the fall. And at that time, they would let us know what we can do to be supportive of that. So that's why we sort of held off. The intent is, I think this fall, probably September, October, they'll start to make some decisions, announcements, and then we could look at reevaluating our plan, our communication plan, and try to do this to be supportive of them, because that's going to help us. I mean, if we can get them to be successful in finding some major revenue sources that can come into the plan, we'll do that. So that's where we are. We basically think that it's, you know, something we want to do, but we got to do it at the right time. We can't just get out in front and jeopardize the whole process. That's where the communication plan is at this point.
Does it require a vote of whatever the decision the city makes? Does it require?
Some do, some don't.
Right.
I mean, some require, I mean, the POB would require a vote of the citizens. Others require a city council vote. Others.
A privatization of assets will require a vote of what? Just of who?
It depends on which assets they're privatizing. If I think, you know, one asset we looked at was landfill. I mean, if they privatized the. They've got a pretty new on-fill landfill. I think that would only be the city council. If it was something different, it may require a number of different people's approvals. So that's the complexity that they're looking to go through to make these kind of decisions. I mean, we looked at the convention centers. We've looked at the AT&T Center. I mean, we looked at parking. We looked at a whole bunch of things and have laid out a lot of options for them. And, you know, hopefully they can prioritize them and get moving on them this fall.
I would think from their perspective, it's not just how to raise the money, but then there would probably be some other people that would want, from the use of proceeds, would say that, you know.
So, oh, I see.
So would probably need to be consensus, my guess, in to actually make anything actually happen. I would assume so.
Yeah, I think, and Kelly's had conversations with the CFO. The CFO has a number of different things they would like to put money into. I mean, they've talked about, you know, depending on the size, you know, they like to solve our problem, but ERF has a similar issue, infrastructure issues, taxes. You know, if they could figure out a way to do a little bit for everybody, that would build the consensus to move forward with whatever they decide.
So one of the questions I have is when we started discussing the communication plan, it addressed different topics within the pension fund and pension system itself, one of which is a funding mechanism, which you've addressed. But then another tentacle of that plan was to address any type of litigation if we had any types of negative impacts from litigation, how we would be communicating that to our members. Are we still developing that portion of the plan, communication plan, or is the whole thing on hold?
I don't remember the litigation piece.
I don't remember that piece either, but right now we've been really on hold. One of the things I think as an interim step would be to have conversations with various council people because, as you know, some of the people that are there now weren't there in 2017.
Right.
And even the people that were in 2017, not all of them remember that the funding level was going to go down for a very long time before it started to come up, and we need to refresh everybody's memory to that.
Yeah.
But so that's one piece. If you think there's additional communication steps to members, that might be another piece. I think right now one of the reasons for the whole the pause is we don't know who we're communicating to and what we're communicating until the city decides what path they're going, whether
I distinctly remember discussing there was a couple of different potential cases out there that if they went one way or another would have a serious negative impact on the fund, on the system. And, you know, what was the plan to communicate to the members that, you know, we're still, just because this thing went negative, we still have a fund, we're still viable, we're still, you know, moving forward, we can still afford to pay you your pension. I remember that being it was a small component of it, but it's still, you know, a part of the plan. So I guess my question is, in the event that some of these cases that are getting ready to go to trial, what's the plan?
Well, the cases that are going to trial won't have a negative impact on the fund regardless of how they come out. It's either going to be zero or positive.
Okay.
The only case, and I'm not going to say anything, that we talked about in the closed session, so don't worry. The only case that could have a negative impact is the case that the DPROA brought related to the COLA. And that is, we won that through the district court, and now we're waiting to see if the DPROA appeals.
But, you know, the truth of the matter is, if we lost that case, we will run out of money, and we would not have money to pay benefits unless we got more, unless the case got reversed or we got more money. So I think you just, I mean, Kelly, you know, yes, we won, and without saying anything confidential, I think we are confident we will continue to win, but, you know, I think we would just have to deal with that on an ad hoc basis as things, you know, transpire.
But that is the only case right now that I believe would have a negative impact on the fund as they stand today.
Okay. But as Kelly discussed, I think we did think it would probably make sense to Kelly and possibly with Nick Wortham to start visiting the city council people in the fall just to make them aware of what our current situation is and where it's going, and so that when they're ready to announce whatever they want to do, they'll be supportive as well. So that'd be more one-on-one. A big PR plan.
Okay.
Would the type of organization we would partner up with differ depending on what avenue we take, or is it going to be the same organization? So, like, if, for example, if we have a bigger, if it's a POB and we have to kind of have this communication plan for the whole city of Dallas versus a more privatized asset sale of maybe that are limited decision makers. I mean, like, how, or we just convey the information as opposed to getting people to kind of see our position?
I think ideally we'll work hand-in-hand with the city and hopefully the business community mm-hmm. to push whatever forward, and everybody would decide what the appropriate role is for DPFP, and, you know, hopefully we're all in agreement, we're all rowing in the same direction would be the, you know.
Especially
the goal.
If the proceeds are going to be split beyond yeah. I mean, like, it's agreeable. We shouldn't have to put the bill if it's going to benefit other departments.
You know, I've always felt that part of the communication plan will be scrutiny on how the reconstituted organization has been since 2017, and that can we sort of report that we can be good stewards of additional capital in order to achieve the long-term goals of the plan, and that's why, you know, little things, big things, middle-sized things, I think they all matter. I think a lot of good stuff has happened. You know, I think we've built a good consensus here with people still, you know, voicing their opinion, and I think it's, you know, in the early days, it was clear who were, you know, mayor appointees or elected from various constituencies, and I think if someone observed now, they wouldn't be able to tell as much. So, you know,
I think when we were talking originally about the communication plan, I think one of the perils that we were kind of seeing is that when you guys went before council, they seemed to think that the problem was fixed. They kept on saying, oh, so it's not going to be a problem. So we're like, no, it's policy, right? We cleaned up governance, we cleaned up policy, but the funding issues still remain. And I think that delineation of messaging was the problem. It's why we even continued to go to communication, because we went back and said, okay, now we need a lot more money. And then they were like, well, we thought it was fixed. We're like, no. The way in which we govern and the way our policies have been fixed, but not the funding.
Yeah.
And I think that was part of the communication plan that needed to be conveyed to the city of Dallas.
I think that's what we've got their attention. They're working on it. And with visiting the city council, we'll make sure everybody's fully aware of what the current status is.
And how much of it is city council versus city manager? Or, again, is it deciding on which decision plan we go with?
I don't know what the city manager's authority is. I would imagine it would be city council issues, given the kinds of numbers we're talking about, but I don't know that. I don't know what he can sign off on. Maybe on a smaller piece, you know, if we decide that they're going to fund actuarially and they're going to dedicate parking revenues or something like that, maybe he could do that. But and on the bigger stuff, I would imagine it's had to be city council.
Mm.
I don't know, Joshua and Kelly, you?
I would imagine it has to be city council, and I think it's always easier to get.
Yeah, this is Mark. Yeah, this is Mark Malvo. That none of that would be able to be done by just city manager. None of that, actually.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's good to know.
All right. Bill, okay. Did I take anything else you want to add about the communication? Okay. All right. Monthly contribution.
Okay, here on page 70 is the monthly contribution report. It is the June report with April data, nothing unusual in this report. We're on track just as we have been since you've been seeing this report. Are there any questions? This repeated story that I tell will change next year, just so you know. So enjoy it right now.
Because
the floor goes down.
So, yeah.
Right. The floor will go down and no longer be in play starting next year.
How much does the floor go down?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Bill. It's on page, this page, 72. You can see 2022, the floor is currently $6,043,000 per biweekly payroll, and next year it goes down to $5,812,000, which basically puts it in line with the hiring plan. And since we're at 103% of the hiring plan, the floor will no longer be in play. It goes down 3.82%.
Then it goes back up in 2024. That's strange.
It just goes down. It goes up slightly, 3.65%, but it still is in line with the hiring plan. So.
But we are on one of those slides that shows that we're negative 140, 150 employees?
Yes. And that's been consistent throughout the, since 2017. They added 25 employees to their estimate this year and didn't make those up. So even though they are gaining a little bit, they keep projecting to add more and more. The reason that we've been keeping up is because of the big raises that they've given in the past
through
years.
Through me, confirm.
Any other questions on that? Okay. The next item is the regular board-approved trustee education and travel. I don't have any requests for these classes or anything else. If anybody would like to attend one of these or add a class, you can do so at this time if you'd like. Otherwise, we wouldn't need a motion on this item.
El Paso, Tennessee. Just noticed that.
What's that?
Oh.
Up and coming town.
It's also in
there,
yeah.
Just a simple typo. Yeah.
That makes it sound a lot more interesting.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows it's in Indiana. There's someone transferred to Indiana.
Okay. Brandon.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Our annual audit that is being conducted by BDO, the field work for that is underway. The PVC list that we received from them, we have completed about 77% of the items that are on that list so far. The items that we cannot complete are things like actuarial information, some investment information, and we're still waiting on that. All of our confirmations have been sent, cash and investment managers, except for legal and actuarial, which are done at the very end of the audit. Most of those have been received back. I think we're still waiting on 5 investment managers to respond. Our member census data has been sent to BDO. They do their own work through actuarial review, and so they have that information to start that process, even though the actuarial report is not yet available. As is usual for us, our largest outstanding item is a couple of big audited financial statements for some investments that we're waiting on. So we receive those. We cannot complete the financial statements, and we cannot start the actuarial work. So we're still waiting on a couple of those.
We missed two or three? What are we missing?
We're missing Lone Star,
and HUP.
CRA, and HUP.
Big ones.
Yes.
Okay. Did we any idea when either HUP particularly may come in? Or?
We had recent communication with HUP, as recent as yesterday, who told us we would have audited financials by July. We are skeptical because last year we did not receive them until late October, November, but hopeful. That would be wonderful if we could get them.
The numbers are probably good with oil prices where they are, so maybe they're getting them out earlier.
So that would be a plus if we could get the HUF July, even, let's say, August 1st. That would put us, you know, a couple of months ahead. But again, we're a little skeptical because that has not been our experience in the last 2 years that we would receive them then.
Yep.
Once we do receive those audited financials, then it should be about 60 days. We'll prepare we'll finish the financials, get those to the actuary. That takes about 30 days for the actuary to complete the actuary report. Once we receive the actuary report, it takes about another 30 days for us to go through the remaining parts of the financials and for BDO to do their final work. So about 60 days from when we receive the final investment financials is when we would project that we would be through with the audit. In the meantime, things are moving forward. We're working on
Mark. I have one comment or question. Is there any risk of the audit with the auditors being delayed or anything? And the reason I ask that, with what's happening in 2024, it's imperative that we do not be in a situation where we have a delayed audit. I think that would not put us in the best light. So I'm just throwing that out there.
Certainly, it is still possible. We would expect generally that our audit would be finished by the end of June or July. But if we do not receive the investment financials, we are delayed until we receive those because they are considered material to the fund, and we cannot proceed without those financials. So, as has been typical in the last 4 years, 3 years that I've been here, the financials typically are finished in October or November as we're waiting on financials to come in. We're unable to control when the investment managers complete their audits and submit their audits to us. Does that answer your question, Mark?
Yes, I'm good. Thank you.
Again, in the meantime, we are working on the audited financials. We're completing the charts and the pieces that we can. We're also working on the annual comprehensive financial report, getting that ready so that we're working as far ahead as we can. So we'll be ready when we do receive those final reports. Are there any questions about the status of the audit?
I do believe there is a chance we might get HUF in the July timeframe because he is actively trying to sell the assets, and I think that might be a requirement. So that's the only thing that is leading me to believe that could be a real date.
A requirement? What do you mean?
Well, I mean, if somebody's going to buy the
company,
they may need, you know, he might be required to give them a recent audit or something like that. Because July is much sooner than he's done it.
And the fund's officially now in liquidation, so he might have more room to shortcut the valuation process that he's used in prior years. So we don't really know what it's going to look like when it comes in.
Well, the auditors have followed his valuation process. I mean, they do it independently, but they've been very comfortable with the process of valuing assets.
Mm-hmm.
We had, and a couple of years ago, we even asked BDO to kind of walk through their process to confirm that it was consistent, reasonable, you know, made sense. to help us with that.
This is a good time to be selling energy assets right now.
Actually, yeah.
Okay. Thank you all.
Brian?
All right. All right, moving into the portfolio update, start with liquidation of the private market assets, which hopefully will include some energy pretty soon here. About $15 million received year-to-date as of end of May. We have $25 million lined up in the next few months, mainly from AEW in the real estate portfolio. We have $10 million coming back from AEW, which should be coming back next week. Just got that notice yesterday. On the safety reserve, as a reminder, at the March board meeting, we notified you guys that we were going to be putting that into drawdown mode to pay net benefit outflows. On EM debt, we have a search underway there, including our current manager, Ashmore. We issued an RFP to seven firms about a week and a half ago, and we have responses due on June 6th, so that's Monday, and we're moving pretty quick through this process. We moved the IC meeting to July 13th, so we plan to interview the finalist firms at that meeting. And then on rebalancing, I'll jump ahead to the slide to show this in a little bit more detail, but we talked about this at high level last board meeting, and then we communicated our plan to the IAC about 2 weeks ago to run it by them and got positive feedback on what we were doing. We funded $40 million to Global Alpha. That's the new international small cap manager. That came from Northern Trust, the passive equity manager. That transaction occurred on Tuesday. So $40 million out of Northern Trust passive into Global Alpha, which is a commingled fund. We are a little bit overweight to bank loans based on them being kind of flat year to date and everything else on the public side being down. So we pulled $5 million out of bank loans and we're using that to add back to global equity. And then the numbers you see at the top of the page here, what we're planning to do probably next week is to equal weight the value. We have four active global managers, two value, two growth. Given the performance rotation from value to growth this year, we're about at our largest difference between the amount invested in value and growth with $40 million more in value, so we want to get those back to equal weight. So that's what we plan to do next week, and that involves transactions with all four managers. Any questions on the rebalancing?
Is that in the package? I'm just trying to find it.
It's on 86 that outlines the amounts going in and out to get the equal weight.
Okay. The Boston Partners were taking money. Their growth, and you're putting it with Invesco?
Boston Partners is value, the most value. Invesco is the most growth.
So we're going from value to growth.
We're going from value to growth to get back to equal weight. And when we did the equity structure review, it says in there, you know, we intend to be at equal weight. We don't have a written policy on how often we're going to equal weight. And as we were going through this, I think that's something we should probably add to the IPS at some point so we're not having to make, you know, should we equal weight now? Should we wait a little bit? Just so we have something a little bit more concrete in the policy that we're going to, you know, equal weight at least once a year, every 6 months, something along those lines. We've had money coming back, so we've pretty much moved that money to get close to equal weight over the last few years when we had to move money into equity. So going back to page 80 here, overall estimated year-to-date return on the total DPFP portfolio is down 7.4%, and then the public markets are down 11.3%. That's up a little bit from what we showed you last month. Looking at the equity market correction, equity markets were up about 6 last week, so they were down kind of at new lows mid-month and recovered a little bit towards the end of the month. Looking at the safety reserve dashboard, ended May, $141 million in the safety reserve, made up of 85 in short-term core bonds with IRM and 56 in cash compared to a target of 162. Net outflows are running at about $9.3 million a month. So the current amount in the safe reserve gives us enough to pay benefit outflows for the next 15 months or through August of 23. The bottom left there shows that it's not just the safe reserve that we have that's liquid. We have another $1.1 billion in liquid public market assets that we can tap if we need to. And then looking at cash flow, we have $55 million in cash right now. We bridged that. We used $40 million from cash to fund the Global Alpha to make sure we had exposure to equity while that trade was occurring. So that's what we're showing. Bottom right, at the top of the cash flow projection, and then with the money coming in from AEW and other distributions, I don't think we're going to need to tap IRM again to pull cash anytime in the next few months. Any questions on cash flow or safety reserve?
The AEW proceeds, you have a high confidence factor in that?
The $10 million for sure. I mean, it's like coming back. That is just excess cash they have that they're distributing.
Okay.
There's another about $20 million from AEW that we have a high level of confidence. It's a bond proceed that's probably going to come in July. So that still needs, there's still some execution risk there, but it's moving forward as of now. So we ended the month at $1.8 billion in NAV, about $45 million, exactly $45 million of outflows related to benefit payments, and then negative $146 in losses in the investment portfolio, and that $146 is up $8 million. So that was 154 last month. Looking at the snapshot of public markets performance, a lot of numbers here, but just wanted to point out, year to date, we're up slightly 80 basis points over a 60-40 public benchmark. A lot of that outperformance is coming from the fixed income portfolio and the lack of duration exposure we had there. That's down 7.2 compared to 11 for the benchmark. And then you can see on the page here where the value versus growth performance difference with Boston Partners only down 1.4% year to date compared to Invesco, the growth manager, down 25.
So we're being very contrarian, taking money from our best manager and giving it to our worst manager.
Yeah, we're rebalancing. So
do we still have confidence in Invesco OFI? Then I mean, or
yes, they're a concentrated manager, and we've talked about that. You know, high exposure to a few really growthy stocks that underperformed. We talked to Makita, kind of underwrote them last month. I wouldn't say they're our highest conviction equity manager, but we. Confident in what they're doing, I don't think now's the time to pull money from them. And I think if their performance doesn't, you know, typically when they underperform, they've recovered when the market recovers. If that doesn't occur, then I think we look at them harder, you know, into next
just
year.
Given our situation, I don't know how concentrated you want to be and how much risk you want to take from the markets. I mean, if you're trying to be full value and growth, you want to represent those and not be way out of whack with one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you may want to take a look at that.
Yeah.
It just concerns me that we...
And then just small piece, but as part of the additional contribution to Invesco, we talked to them and got a little bit of a fee concession from them. So they'll save about $20,000 to $40,000 a year on fees, depending on how much money we have with them.
Brian, is the IAC on board with that rebalancing?
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, I think what we should do is just kind of make it more structured on how often to do it, so we're not having to try to make these decisions around timing of value versus growth. And Aaron, anything you want to add there on Invesco? Or
yeah, I'd just say, you know, minus 25% looks like a big number in isolation, but relative to kind of the peers and this growthy, mostly large cap space, we've seen some really horrible numbers to start the year. So any strategy that had done very, very well for the last few years and kind of benefited from this tech and stay-at-home cycle has really struggled in the start of this year. And other groups are doing something similar, which is trying to buy low, you know, taking advantage of the sell-off. And trying to just keep the long term in mind and block out the short term pain. Kind of add as it did.
And that benchmark we're showing, the 25 versus the 12.9, that's a core benchmark. The growth benchmark is probably down 22 to 23. So they're still underperforming the growth benchmark, but it's a lot closer to where they're at.
You know, I'll also note the four global managers are performing in the exact order you'd expect them to. 2 years ago, it was the exact reverse.
Yeah.
And Boston Partners was the troubled child.
Yes.
And we all were questioning our conviction there. And we, you know, consultants love to say their style is out of favor. Well, now their style is in favor, and you can see they're outperforming by 12 percentage points. So what we get concerned is, as Ryan mentioned, if you see the reverse again, and they don't kind of do what you what their role is, that's what we get really.
Moving ahead here, already outlined the rebalancing. This chart looks at S&P inter-year declines. Talked about this last few months, but average inter-year drop 14%. This year we were down to 19, and we're down 13 now, so up a little bit off the bottom. And then this is the asset class returns over the last 15 years, and then year-to-date, commodities still are the only thing that are positive. So we do have some exposure there in the private portfolio, as we've talked about. Looking ahead at the investment review plan, we're going to have Hancock in next month in person to do a review of the ag portfolio, and then we're going to move into the staff reviews of private infrastructure and then fixed income equity and private equity.
On the prior chart, we don't show an EM debt at all on this chart, does it?
Which one?
The one that asset classes. This one right here, yeah.
No, they have a separate one that does it by fixed income category that should have it. I'll send it to you after the meeting. But
yeah, just as you're starting to look to hire a new manager, maybe we want to just get an idea where it would have fallen in this group over the last couple of years.
It's definitely struggled to that.
Okay,
with that, I'll hand it over to Aaron to go through their presentation. Based on board's request a couple months ago, instead of just doing the performance reports, they're going to do a macro update and say what they're seeing and what they're looking at right now. So over to you, Aaron.
Thanks, Ryan. So the main event is this market update, and then we'll follow with the more standard performance reports. So I'll walk you through a couple of charts trying to explain what's going on, with a particular focus on the fact that we have this environment where bonds and stocks are going down together, so the classic diversification isn't really working. Then we'll kind of provide a few forward-looking opinions, try to give you some glimmers of hope out there. And I have my colleague, Richard O'Neill. You on, Richard?
I am. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Hey, Richard.
So Richard is the head of our global macro committee. So I'll let him provide some thoughts. They just had one of their committee meetings yesterday. At the end, I'll give the floor to him. He can provide some thoughts on what they discussed yesterday. And hopefully, we can get into a bit of a question and answer session. So Richard's group. First off, we have a real way with words here, so eloquently put it, a terrible start to the year. So what they did is they looked back at basically the inception of the S&P 500, so about 100 years worth of history, and the same with the bond market with the ag, and looked at what is the average return at this point in the year, first 4 months, and where are we this year? So on the equity side, down 13% through the end of April, and May just finished up at quasi-flat for both the stocks and bonds, so these numbers are still pretty applicable. But that's the third worst start to the equity market in basically 100 years. Mm. On the bond side, the worst start. So in any given year, you know, you have this noise. But what's really frustrating is that you have both occurring at the exact same time. So the classic diversification stocks and bonds is not helping. Groups that were more conservative or more aggressive kind of all are rising and falling together. Stocks and bonds are doing the same thing. So why is that? So I'm going to walk you through this chart, and the way you do it is start, it all starts with COVID, naturally, and then we go around like a clock. So 2 years ago, COVID hits and the world stops. We're not doing anything, we're not producing anything, so markets crater. And U.S. Central Bank and central banks around the world implement a ton of fiscal policies. We have paycheck protection programs, people don't lose their jobs, we have stimulus checks, loan deferment, rent deferment, inject all this capital into the markets, and it worked. Stock market went straight down, went straight back up. So you have equities going up because of this fiscal policy. But because we've all sat at home for a year, people have money coming in and generally didn't travel or spend as much, we all want to go out now and do everything. Buy a bunch of stuff, travel. You have limited supply of nearly everything and the same demand or increased demand. So inflation hits, and it certainly has not been transitory, like we've all thought. So this environment, if you're 8% inflation, who wants to own a bond that's yielding 2%, 3%? So people start selling off their bonds. So the inflation environment is really what I argue killing the bond market more so than going around the clock, the Fed. So you get to the Fed's needed reaction here. Everyone argues they're behind the eight ball, didn't act fast enough. So now we need to really ramp up and act quickly to curtail inflation. So when the Fed is in a rate-rising environment, people sell bonds again. And generally, we all believe that the market consensus usually is that the Fed is going to screw it up. So you have bonds going down and equities going down together. The fear that, you know, this leads to a too hard of a landing and you kind of tip us into a recession. So if you just end there, you know, that's up to probably about February. You could argue that maybe some of this real sell-off could have been avoided, but then you throw in this war, which introduces more kind of uncertainty, geopolitical risk, and more supply-side issues. Energy prices up. So you have the same effects now, even more thin. So again, equities down and bonds down. So it's this mix of things all coming together that basically has resulted in correlation, you know, being the same, stocks and bonds going down together. So how unusual is this relative to history? You see a big spike in the correlation on the far right in the circle. They're rolling two-year correlation numbers. It wasn't that unusual relative to long-term history. So in the 70s and 80s, you have kind of high correlation together. But that's fine if stocks are up and bonds are up. What's happening now is you have correlation together when both are going down. And we've just had this environment the last, say, 20 years, where generally classic asset allocation has worked. You can see when the blue is down below, that means stocks and bonds are negatively correlated, which is what we all learn and what we all hope and plan for. So that's all what's happened and what's happening. So what's going to happen going forward? Well, everybody has an opinion, and I don't know how much weight you can really put into forecasts. You know, the classic data points on it, if you look at, this is the Fed funds futures expectations. The blue is where we started the year. So that was the kind of path that everyone thought the Federal Reserve would take this year in terms of raising short-term rates. And then the green is just 4 months later. And you can see entirely different path because of all those things that transpired. Basically, the point is all the experts project and project, but nobody really knows. So we've got to take it all with a grain of salt. We show here a couple of tables, kind of what happened after past sell-offs. You know, typically there is a bounce. Can't rely on that. But you can see the yellow boxes are where we are, and then the other years are those other, you know, top 10 worst starts. You can see 8 out of 10 years, or 7 out of 10 years on the equity side, you see double-digit gains, and the same on the bond market side. But again, you can't just buy blindly.
Aaron, on the fixed income losses on the U.S. ag, how much of the rate increases have already been priced in to the losses we've seen through April?
Yeah, so I'll get to that with the kind of the green quote. I would argue that don't price.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that I was at a board meeting on Tuesday, and there was some trustee who was gung-ho that Fed's going to raise rates, bonds are going to go down, and everyone knows they're going to raise rates. So you could argue that the market has priced it in. People have sold off the bonds with this knowledge already. And everything I've shared today, I hope it's not new news. You know, everyone knows inflation is up and Fed's going to raise rates. So I think a lot of it, or almost all of it, is priced in.
Okay.
All right, so what are the possible glimmers of hope? I mean, I think we all know the bad. You know, I think anytime there is a sell-off, you know, investment assets are cheaper, similar to the contrarian rebalancing, so you have opportunities to kind of grind it out and not panic and take advantage of discounts. The bond market is healthier now. So pension plans that are going to earn 3-4% on high-quality bonds, that's a much better environment than before when we were earning 1%, you know, on 10-year treasury. So I think that creates a healthier environment. The inflation story seems to be peaking a little bit. There are better numbers coming out. There are less tankers sitting off the port of L.A. You see the housing market cooling off. So a lot of these things might be signs that we might kind of cool off on the inflation side, which will help a lot of those issues that we talked about previously. There's the possibility that because markets are down, inflation may be cooling, that the Fed's path, that 275, may actually be too aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so you could see a nice positive rebound if the Fed decides that they don't need to tighten as much. Markets might view that positive. And then the final thing I'll add before passing over to Richard is kind of sentiment. And there's a good, I don't know if anyone reads Howard Marks, famous investor. He just he writes these memos every couple of months. He published one this week. And his point was that humans are not rational actors all the time. And we overswing both ways. And we certainly overswung on the ride up, and potentially, and usually, we overswing on the way down. And so when sentiment is really poor, and it is poor, that means that likely that's the best time for a kind of rebound back the other way. So all those things like, you know, the Fed may have to be overly aggressive in his plan. All these things that kind of everyone is forecasting is such a grave possibility coming up that incrementally better news could result in kind of market stabilizing and rebound to top.
What's your thought on the war and, you know, the length of it or what happens in various scenarios?
I think probably markets are predicting that it's long and painful. So any news that it, any positive news out of that could, you know, also similar to the topic, be viewed positively by the equity markets, and you could have a bump. I don't know, Richard, do you have anything more eloquent than that?
Yeah, I think that the main, you know, issue with the war, you know, as I'm sure you and many of our clients don't have a lot of direct exposure to Russia in your portfolio. So it's sort of the derivative effects of that, meaning how much do you trade with Russia or depend on them for things. Here in the U.S., that is pretty low. The percentage of our global trade with Russia is extremely low. That is a different story in Europe, for example, where some countries heavily depend on Russia. And you might have seen a story earlier this week where they have decided to stop all trade with Russia related to oil over the sea. They still do have some pipelines that they're going to keep going on, but that's going to take some time for those countries to pivot away from oil from Russia, and that's going to have economic impacts there. So I think for the U.S., it's less of an impact, but for countries like Europe, it is going to probably be a harder hit to their GDP. Their currency is declining in Europe, which is different than the U.S. dollar, which is strengthening. So all of that, you know, lower currency, inflation, dependence on Russia, I think will have impacts on Europe and other countries that depend on Russia for particularly energy.
Richard, anything material coming out of the Macro Investment Committee meeting you had this week?
Sure. So first, thanks for having me today. Sorry I couldn't be there in person. As Aaron mentioned up front, I chair this group we call the Global Macro Investment Committee, and our job is to sort of put out all this material, the things that Aaron is showing you here, the memos you receive from us about the markets, the webinars we host all sort of come out of this group. And the other thing we're tasked with is coming up with the firm views on the market, the economy. And like most of our clients, you know, you're not trying to make tactical moves. You're a long-term strategic investor. But, you know, we think it's important to have views and perspectives on things. So we meet monthly. We met yesterday, and I'm happy to share some of the conversations and the things we're talking about. And I think Aaron did a nice job of covering a lot of them. So maybe I can just sort of take a trip around the world, and I'll start with the U.S. And I think, like Aaron mentioned, you know, when we came into this year, people were saying we thought inflation was going to be transitory. We thought GDP growth was going to be 5 or 6% here. And we thought the Federal Reserve was going to slowly raise interest rates. And as he showed you, that quickly changed. Growth forecasts have come down quite a bit. We are not expecting inflation to go away anytime soon, and we are expecting the Fed to raise rates much faster than they have in a long time. So all of that has led to what we've seen in the markets. And I think to the question about are things priced in, I think the Fed policy is priced in. But I think as you watch market releases, you'll see that the market is reacting to everything that comes out. Like yesterday, we got a jobs report. We got a manufacturing report. And there are some signs of the unemployment market being really tight. And, you know, rates went up. The market fell off. And we're seeing the same thing as earning reports are coming in. So clearly, I think the main issues in the U.S. are what is the Fed ultimately going to do? And how does inflation track from here? And those are the things we talked a lot about. And to Aaron's point, you know, our view is we're maybe getting close to peak Fed hawkishness, or hawkishness meaning how aggressive they're going to be. And there are some signs of inflation rolling off in terms of shipping costs and transportation, et cetera. So I think as we look at that, if we are hitting that peak level, I'm not saying we are for sure, but it's something we're watching, then a lot of the things Aaron pointed to might be supportive for the U.S. Now, and I'll add a few to that. So we have a healthy consumer here. We have a healthy corporate landscape with companies buying back shares. And even though that we have GDP coming down from where we expected it, 5-6%, it is likely that we will be going back to a level of GDP that we've had for a while. So a 2-3% GDP here in the U.S. Is not the end of the world. The markets have done really well in environments where GDP was growing at 2-3%. The other thing is, although interest rates are higher and are going to be helpful to bond investors, interest rates aren't as high as what we saw in the 70s and 80s, making really hard to borrow money. So we think that if we are getting to the peak of hawkishness, the peak of inflation, there's a relatively nice landscape here in the U.S. of at-trend growth, strong consumers, strong corporate health. Now, to Aaron's point, the way that can go wrong is, if the Fed does not get inflation under control, they raise rates, they put the economy into a recession, and that wouldn't be a great environment for any investment. We don't put that as a high probability, but we think that the probability of that has increased just as the further we go along with inflation being this high. But our base case is not a recession. It's just a slowing in growth from where we saw at the start of the year. Beyond that, we don't have as much ties to Russia as Europe does. Our currency is strong. So I think part of a lot of the discussion of the committee yesterday was talking about the risk of the hard landing in the U.S., which we don't think is high, but really thinking about, if the dust settles here, what do things look like in the U.S.? And all these points I made here, I think, were things that we look to as positives.
Thank you, Richard.
Any questions on the U.S. part? I can quickly talk about outside of the U.S.
as well. Flattened. So is there still more risk in the longer, intermediate to longer end of the curve? I mean, if they have not gone up nearly.
Yeah, so I think the big thing there, I think to the question earlier about pricing in Fed policy, we see the long end reacting pretty quickly to these releases. The back end went up yesterday with the jobs report. So I would say, it's pricing in the information we're getting from corporate updates and from the Fed and economic reports. I think the one big wild card at the back end of the curve that we're keeping an eye on and don't really know how it's going to play out is that the Federal Reserve is going to unwind. It's already stopped purchasing bonds, but it's going to unwind its program. And the Fed has been a significant buyer of long-term treasury. So as you pull that long-term buyer out of the market, it's sort of unclear how that's going to play out. So I think our base case is that the yield curve might slowly continue to steepen this year for inflation reasons and for the dynamic of the Fed rolling out. So I think we're going to have to watch and see if the 10-year gets back over 3% again. Does it sort of go past the last peak, which I think was around 3.1, 3.2?
On the other side of that, with equities, what is your opinion with the growth versus value that is happening right now? I mean, growth has taken a real shellacking. Like, where do you go from here? You kind of almost sense that it was overdone, but is it?
Yeah. So, I think we have a couple dynamics, and I think it's the same. We would agree with you. Like, we're kind of watching. It's been a very strong, fast move, and so I think it's going back to the themes that have driven it. I think first one is during the pandemic, there was this sort of so-called stay-at-home trade where we all signed up for Peloton and Netflix and fixed our backyards and whatever else we did. but now there's clear evidence that we are moving away from goods purchases to services purchases. And we've seen companies like Facebook and Netflix and Peloton all get hit, you know, a lot of those big tech companies. And then, you know, just the math of interest rates going up disproportionately hurts growth stocks because more of their earnings are priced into the future, and just sort of the math of valuing a company that hurts them. It seems like all companies are going down in this environment, but regardless of their growth and earnings prospects. So probably some companies are getting pulled down just from the trend. But it's been, to your point, a very strong, fast trend. And when things like that happen, we sort of keep an eye on, you know, potential reversals or as Aaron mentioned, things getting overdone. We'll have to see. I mean, if rates keep going up and people keep transitioning away from some of these big key tech stocks, you know, maybe it could continue a little bit in the short term.
A lot of those, like, tech growth stocks are below now where they were pre-pandemic, so they've been, like, completely round tripped.
Supply
is, like, these shortage in chips and cars and all of this other craziness that would happen. Like, you were paying a premium, like, people were going to buy cars, and they said, no, that's a sticker price, but add 20% to it.
I did that.
You know what I'm talking about? I see. We saw a lot of things like that.
Yeah.
So if that issue, like you say, the ships are kind of just, you don't see them docked up in the waters and on the Pacific coast, then some of that is getting worked out into the system as well. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think the other tricky thing with the global supply chain is China has sort of taken this no-nonsense approach to COVID, where they are just don't want to have any cases. You've probably seen in the news that Shanghai is opening a little bit. But, you know, we're a little leery there, and it seems like the government is willing to quickly lock things down again. And as we know here, this virus ebbs and flows. The reason I bring that up is obviously China is a major part of the global supply chain, and to the extent that they're locking down huge parts of the economy and manufacturing could create some issues going forward with, you know, or continued issues going forward as it relates to chips and other technology things. But to Aaron's point, I mean, when we say we see inflation easing, we're seeing more movement in transportation. We're seeing the cost of transportation starting to come down. We were seeing that in some commodities. Unfortunately, oil has gone back up over the last couple of days for a variety of reasons, but we have seen some other, you know, lumber has come down quite a bit. Some parts of the food complex have come down. But then again, there you compare that with wheat production and corn coming out of Ukraine and other things coming out of Europe that have gone up because of the war. So it doesn't seem, it seems like we're getting some pressures coming off of inflation, but I think it's going to be a while for inflation to really cool down. I'm cognizant of time. I'm happy to talk about outside of the U.S. and EM if that's of interest to you or anything else on your mind.
Got a couple more questions.
Yeah, I just got a couple. Any tactical or moves or asset allocation shifts you guys are making in your discretionary portfolios or you've seen clients do, Aaron or Richard?
So, Aaron, I don't have any – I mean, I don't have any MFM clients. So I'm not sure what's been going on there. I mean, I can speak to the views of the Global Macro Group if that's helpful.
Yeah, I know some have they've done the growth versus value rebounce back. Outside of that, they make very minor, you know, like a little extra duration, a little shorter duration. So, but Richard's group puts out a kind of short-term viewpoint in terms of overweight, underweight, U.S., non-U.S., things like that. So what's the shortest, simplest way to describe positioning, Richard?
Yeah, so we voted before. So basically we vote before our meetings and we have a discussion and at our meetings and we follow up afterwards. But I can give you a perspective of sort of where members voted going into the meeting that we had yesterday. And I think I've covered it. I haven't sort of talked about non-U.S., but generally for a lot of reasons that I mentioned, the group is a little bit in favor of U.S. equities. It's not a screaming, we love U.S. equities, but it's almost like it's the best place to be if you want to be a little bit overweight somewhere in equities. And the reason for that is if you look outside within Europe and Japan, you have largely energy importers, you have weakening currencies, you have lower growth, you have central banks that aren't as active. And then if you look in emerging markets, I sort of talked about China, which had slowing growth before COVID lockdowns. But if you look outside of China, inflation really hits a lot of EM economies where about a third of consumption is related to food. So food price increases particularly hurt emerging markets. So within equities, I think we are a little bit in favor of U.S., a little either neutral to underweight EFA, EM equities. Looking within the bond market, we are, I think, generally sort of neutral around things. I think we're looking for signs that maybe things are peaking. We were more negative on duration, but for a lot of the reasons we've talked about, we're just looking for trends to maybe be peaking here. But for right now, I think we think there are pluses and minuses for being long and short duration. Within credit, sort of similar view for is the U.S. stock market. For the same reasons you would like U.S. stocks, you might like corporate bonds, but it's not a strong view for corporate bonds in the U.S. And then outside of that, we have been overweight, had an overweight view in commodities for a little bit. But again, we've pulled that back just because we feel like it's been a pretty strong run.
Okay, thank you. And then on the, like, when you guys come out with your 20-year go-forward return assumptions early next year, like, how much does having bonds earning 3 to 4% do you think affect the go-forward return expectations for portfolio like ours compared to zero, you know, close to zero rates?
Pretty significantly. Okay. So bonds are the easiest asset class to forecast what their future return will be because it's pretty much the yield. So yield doubled, you know, that's pretty much doubling of the return expectation, you know, when you're talking about high, you know, investment grade style bonds.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I didn't know how much built in to increase over 20 years, so but we'll see what it comes out. But I think those kind of probability of earning 6.5 charts could look a little bit better than they did last time around.
Yeah, that's the expectation. You have when things are cheaper, forward-looking projections are better. When bond yields are higher, forward-looking return projections are better. So the exact opposite. This is a good time. All right. So
it's fair to say that there's no peer institutions you're aware of that really are changing the way they're doing things in response to what's happened so far.
That's very fair.
Okay.
And the topics of the day, and I think you guys have exposure ready, infrastructure and real assets. Those are where most boards are spending their time. So,
And then, Ryan, maybe something you could comment on, if not today, maybe the next meeting, what macro conditions would change and to what extreme before you would start thinking that we need to do something else? So, I mean, just, you know, that, because I think what we're hearing is that definitely we're in, you know, negative markets, incredibly high correlations between, you know, equities and bonds, so there's no place to hide, but for if you somehow were, you know, overexposed to commodities and natural resources and, you know, things like that. So what would have to get more tony and more negative or before you would say, hey, we need to think about doing something else? So that's just something going forward, if we stay in these sort of markets that you should comment on. So.
Okay. And, I mean, I think when you look at asset allocation down the road or next year, I think there's probably areas of fixed income that we've avoided duration-wise that may be more attractive to look at that we don't have in the portfolio, but it's more longer term.
And then clearly, I don't think I'm the sole repository of irony here that we're in some of the asset classes that you would want to be in
but maybe we didn't quite get into that. We didn't quite get into, you know, the right floor or the right store or whatever. But, you know, some of these commodities in oil and gas, we actually...
I see a lot of the pension funds and investments are getting a lot more into private equity and private debt, but we've got the liquidity concerns.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
So you've got to sort of evaluate at what point you do some of that on the margin, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, if there's a liquidity issue that changes down the line, I mean, that's when you could seriously consider that.
That's,
you know,
exactly right.
I will make a comment about the rebalancing because I'm hearing from staff that you want some kind of direction a little bit about the timing or when we should do that. So that doesn't go, like, unheard. I also think that that was the whole point of the reserve. I mean, the way we have to rebalance now is the way we should be doing things. Not with the consideration of the current markets, I think that it will work itself out, i.e. 15 months from now, a year from now, it's a very different market. So the way we position ourselves according to the way we did the policy now will be beneficial in the future, but it's hard to see that. So it may be looking like we're taking a contrarian approach, but I think in the long run it will work out.
Yeah.
Or that's the way the mechanism should be, right? So as far as the direction of when and how much, I think that's just...
Yeah, we'll talk to Makita. Like, I think we've...
You know what I'm saying?
Semi-annually or something like that, and it's a little bit more controlled.
A change of asset allocation because of what's happening in fixed income is a different discussion.
Yeah.
But in which the manner in which you have these monies available and then you start, you know, if you do it all at once or you do it over time, I mean, if, you know, I don't have I don't disagree with what you've done so far, is what I'm saying.
And I think another discussion, you know, if this downturn is prolonged, you know, what we do with cash flows coming in, you know, right now may be different than what we want to do if we only have 4 months left on the safety reserve, or if we're deeper into this, or if stock markets go down another 20%, we might want to be more aggressive on redeploying cash coming in into equities as opposed to keeping it in the safety reserve.
But as we get money, let's say, from AEW, what have you, it would go into the reserve anyway?
Right now, what we talked to the IC about is to fill that back up to target,
right?
Which
is target what? 18 months?
We're 18 million below target right now, roughly. So we have money come in, we fill it back up to target, and then anything above that, which could happen in June or July with the next big AEW distribution, would go into equity.
Right.
But the plan right now is to fill it back up to target and then look at redeploying.
Richard, thank you for time this morning.
Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, thank you, everyone. Nice to chat with you. Look forward to chatting in the future.
Great.
Take care.
So, recognize you have some attorneys coming in about 10, 15 minutes, so we'll keep you on time. I'm going to try to hit some slides in the performance section that are not kind of duplicative or dated from some of the information that Ryan and staff shared. So, you know, this is the liquidity exposure. We were talking about that a little bit. The left is your actual exposure. The right is the target. And progress has been made, certainly. You know, I remember when we started, and this new board kind of was just about a year into its formation, the left side, I think the pink was about half. So, you're definitely, the pictures are starting to look, the picture on the left is starting to get and look like the picture on the right. So progress is being made, distributions are coming back, and exposure is becoming more liquid and more on track with targets.
So for the people on the phone, Aaron's on page 108 now.
106,
sorry.
Now I'm on 107. Another point, so this is the quarterly manager scorecard. And, you know, for a second, you know, ignore the greens and the red and look at this five-year column. Everything is not applicable. So this board really has redesigned the whole public markets portfolio. You have two strategies that have been there for 5 years, but everything else doesn't even have a five-year tracker. So I would view this as, one, you know, a lot of work has been completed, but it's still pretty young. You know, this, you haven't let any of the strategies really run their course yet. This page here on 108 goes to some of Richard's points, something that Bill, you talked about in the past. This is looking at your equity regional exposure versus the broad kind of universe. So if you look either at the gray line and below, or if you use the chart, the DPSP's public equity is the light blue on the far left, and the light green right to its right is the benchmark, the active MI. So for a long time, there was a big underweight to U.S. and a big overweight to developed non-U.S., so Europe, Japan, et cetera. And that has been shrinking. So we're getting closer to kind of neutral exposure in terms of your regional allocation relative to the universe. I think it was, at one point, you were down in like 40% in the U.S., and I got to 54. The index is at 60%.
Now, with Boston Partners losing some money, that'll probably improve that ratio as well, weren't they?
Yeah, but we've also just funded $40 million into international small cap. So part of that increase is we only had exposure to U.S. small cap based on the timing. So, but a lot of the active managers, you know, the four active, they're underweight to U.S. have come down. So,
okay, so this is always one of my favorite charts, and this, so if you look at the bottom, this is a 1 year performance attribution. The actual return for DPSP for the 12 months ending in March, -1%. Your policy was +5, so 6 percentage points of underperformance. And so this chart is a visual way, and you guys can use this if questions come up about underperformance or where's performance, what's driving it. This is a visual interpretation of where performance has detracted or added value. So green is the effect of the managers chosen, and blue the effect of overweight and underweight certain asset classes relative to targets. Now, despite all the progress that has been made, the anchor stays an anchor for a really long time. So you have giant green to the left with private equity. So we know the story there. The effect of the managers that this system has relative to the universe of private equity, and the same with the green on real estate.
And private equity is on a quarter lag, so in the 1 year trailing, we're seeing the 2021 year in March is what's driving that to the left.
Yeah. Look at the global equity line. So over this period, you have an underweight global equity. You've been working for years now to get up to that target. So the blue shows the effect of that underweight. So it was negative, but it's really minor relative to the other effects, you see. And the green to the left of global equity, also this is the effect of the four managers during this period underperforming the benchmark. Again, negative, but really pales in comparison to kind of the other things that are driving the results.
But at the same time, a fair observation would be that what you said on private equity and real estate are issues we've inherited that we've looked to minimize. But, you know, in the global equity, like, that's one where that's on us, you know, to the extent you want to hold us accountable on our stewardship from investing. It's not a big deviation, but I think it's important to know, you know, where we say, oh, we've inherited all these issues, and that's true, but then there are areas where we can look at our own judgments and say, hey, we've underperformed a little bit here, or we've overperformed there. And I think it's always good to have a healthy visual
on that. It's a good chart.
Although I'd say, I mean, 1 year is too short to evaluate anybody on. I mean, you've got to be looking at 3 and 5 year kind of numbers to make that accountability. Yeah.
I would agree with that. Both points. And I'll give you one cop out too, though. The green we own. The manager's underperforming in that small period. The blue on global equity, I would argue that you don't own that. You want more. You wanted more exposure there, but you have been unable to get the exposure there. So that's the effect of having a high target but not being able to ramp it up.
Yeah, that's true.
To wrap it up shortly, but again on this theme of what is controllable and what is not controllable, so we show the, it's on 114. Just quick, laser works. You're looking at the third or fourth line down, total fund ex private markets. You see a 3 year and a 5 year number of close to 8%, close to 7%. And this is, you know, inclusive of this, you know, as we mentioned, this terrible start to the year. So at least the first 3 months. So you could argue that, you know, the things that the board can control, the equity managers, the bond managers, and this is inclusive of the safety reserve, which is that cushion we're forced to have given the constraints and benefit issues. Generally, kind of meeting the bogey, 8%, 7% over a 3 to 5 year period.
In the longer term on the total fund ex private markets, we had more in fixed income. We build up the equity to get closer. We're above 60-40 now, but like when you look at the longer term trade, we get a lower allocation to equity. Bringing some of that down too.
And wrapping up shortly, infrastructure. See the bottom gray. Great year, 65%. So it's not all bad. That was we get lucky a little bit, but that's the shipping investment. So this has been, you know, every quarter was up, you know, another 15% as that environment became in high demand.
You can make one other comment. Help us say this. So if you look at 1 year global equity, us versus the index, we're trailing by 100 basis points, right? 5.3 versus 6.3. And that's kind of a real-time scoreboard. When you look at private equity, we're down 30, and the index is up 21.5. That's an incredibly distorted numbers, both not our number, it is what it is, but the index, because it really doesn't any of the cause and effect from the public market downturn in the first quarter in that number, because the private equity firms don't report yet, or it's on a lag, that their burden of scrutiny and marking things down in quarters, they do on their audits, they have a higher standard there, but they're quarterly, so you're just going to see a lot of funky things where there's a lot of clarity and visibility to how public securities get marked, but on the privates, there's time lag issues, there's, you know, level 3 valuation, I mean, there's all sorts of things, and they're going to do everything they can to produce the best, you know, reported numbers and IRRs and all that kind of stuff. So it's just, you know.
Yeah, the artificial lack of volatility in private equity. Because you don't, like your home price doesn't go up and down with the stock market, so you don't see that noise.
Aaron, why don't you talk about the change we had to do on the private equity benchmark?
We'll bring you to a page you've never seen. The benchmark history page.
Going deep into the footnotes. Yeah.
So the private equity benchmark is a...
What page are you on there?
We're on page 126. A relevant topic because we had a discussion with staff a couple weeks ago, made a recommendation for a change there. Historically, the benchmark in private equity was the Cambridge Associates private equity universe. So this is what we call peer universe benchmark. Cambridge Associates aggregates thousands and thousands of private equity fund performance and produces kind of this is the number for what private equity has done in the quarter. We made a firm-wide recommendation to change that approach for a couple of reasons. It started with Cambridge Associates changing its licensing requirements for the universe of plans and consultants that use it, and not allowing anyone to use it anymore unless individual the money making thing. Unless individual plans, DPFP, you know, City of XYZ, buy a license directly with them. And the other consulting firms wanted to buy a package and then use it for our clients. So they're not allowing that. They want groups to do it directly.
How
yeah.
much? You know how much?
About $10,000 per benchmark. But on each plan for that same, whatever that number. So, you know, some groups that have big private equity programs that are, we think it made sense. Others, it doesn't make sense. So we looked holistically at our approach and discovered that, you know, there's, with any of these benchmarks in private equity, they're all flawed. They all fail the classic CFA definition of what is a good benchmark. Is it investable? Is it transparent? Is it known in advance? All those. They all have flaws. But we made the recommendation here to use the public market plus a spread approach on a lag. So that's what's incorporated for the last quarter, about 2 quarters. So your point's still valid, Nick, because the sell-off is the 1 quarter result. So those are not in there yet.
The key point, how much is the spread that you put in there?
3%.
Okay. 2 to 4 is pretty typical.
Yeah. So the biggest thing is if you, aside from the money and the licensing and all that, you invest in private equity because you think you're going to earn more than public equity. So it meets the biggest requirement of a benchmark. You know, what is our objective here? And it hits on a number of the other definitions that are better than this old approach. So that's the approach we have here. If in the future, in 5 years, we're redoing the private equity program and investing, and there's apples to apples instead of apples to oranges, then maybe we reconsider that other, you know, expensive option.
What you're doing is consistent with what almost all corporations do, pension funds. I don't know about the public sector, but clearly the pension funds are using a spread versus public.
Okay. So, you know, this is more of an operational thing here, but it will be incorporated into the investment policy statement the next time there's... I guess I'll end it here. You know, this is 5 year picture of how the exposure has changed. And you see the blue is our public equities, and back in the day, about 10% in stock markets. So you're growing and growing, and you're trying to get to that column on the right. And a lot of progress has been made. You'll start seeing the fruits of the labor when the colors stop moving so dramatically. Once you start getting into an environment where there's stability, and so you're getting, you know, the ups and the downs kind of equally and not subject to the misfortunes of time. But a lot of progress has been made here.
It looks like beach erosion.
That's a big allocation for private equity, though.
The that classic plan that I've mentioned many times in the past, we have a 10-year one there, and it looks like email. It goes like this. So I'll share you offline, but it's a classic. It's quite the picture. All right. Any questions?
Is that allocation right on the, I mean, is that large of an allocation, what people are striving for?
What?
That's our target on the right.
What?
That's where we were.
Oh, that's where we were. Okay, got it. Wow.
Yeah, you have a target of 55?
Yeah, most are in the 12, 13% range these days.
Yeah, the blue is public equity, not private.
Okay.
I was confused. Thank you. You caught that.
Great. Well, we appreciate what you're doing. Thanks. Everything's your team solid and.
Yeah. Leo's in his regards. He just got in late from France. He was on vacation with his family, but the firm is growing. Doing well.
Good.
They'll be back in July, so.
Okay, so we are going to go into closed session now.